MacGas, Tuesday, April 29th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another episode, and what an episode I've got lined up for you. We got lots of things to talk about. First and foremost, Apple had its quarterly results call, and I'm going to give you my thoughts and impressions on that, also run down some of the highlights. We've got rumors of Apple and Nike collaborating on the iWatch project, also a bunch of software updates, including one for iOS. We're going to talk about the latest on iPhone rumors, as well as some new Macs that hit the streets just today. We've got all of that. And, of course, your comments and questions, some feedback, some follow-up on the last couple episodes, including an easier way to clean out those dynamic link library cache files on your Mac that we talked about last time. Apple may have been hit, at least in one area, by the heartbleed bug, and we're going to update you on that and tell you how you can deal with it if you're impacted. And also some tips on merging PDFs, as well as I'm going to give you my comments on why I think it's not quite time to completely cut the cord, at least not for most people, with respect to your media files. That and a bunch of other tips and hints and tricks and all sorts of stuff in this episode. We're going to get to all of that in just a minute. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Rage Software. They make an application called Everweb that you're going to really want to know about, because one of the tools that I know a lot of you miss from Apple's iLife suite is iWeb. I get emails all the time asking about, what am I going to do about iWeb? I loved that software for building and maintaining my website, but as you know, Apple left it behind when they moved to iCloud. Well, the guys over at Rage Software, the folks over at Rage Software, have developed a solution that I think is the first real iWeb replacement that we've seen. So Everweb can bring back that full iWeb experience in terms of ease of use and functionality, but then it goes way beyond that, because Everweb offers a bunch of features for modern web development. Things like having mobile templates, that's so critical now. Your site needs to be able to be displayed on mobile devices, and that is built right in. They make it really easy to do. They have easy drag and drop site creation with great templates that can get you up and running and started. Of course, you can dive in and get as deep or not as you would like. They have master pages, which makes it really easy to update common elements like your menus and your footers and things like that. A bunch of great widgets. So if you need to add a Google map, or you want to add a contact form, or you need to do social media integration with your Twitter and your Facebook and your Google, all that stuff is in there, just drag and drop easy. And they have those modern advanced features. So full HTML5 support, including HTML5 audio and video. Great if you're like me and a podcaster, you want to put a little player on your website, you can do that. Integration with Google Fonts, so you can make your fonts and typography look great. SEO support, so search engine optimization, if you need to get up in those rankings, that's all built in there too. And great, like I said, designed templates. And you have the option, you have a couple different options when you go to publish. They have a standalone version of the app that you can get, and that will allow you to upload and publish FTP to your own hosting. Or they have the easy one-click publishing, just like you had in iWeb, with the Everweb with hosting edition. So you can get all your hosting and the software all in one package. And best of all, because you're a MacCast listener, you can get 15% off by using the code MacCast at checkout. If you want to get all the information and details, you can see the software, download it, try it out. It's over at everwebapp.com. And be sure to use that coupon code MacCast to get your 15% off. And a big thank you to Rage Software for their support of the show. Last week, Apple had its Q2 earnings results call, its second quarter earnings results call, and I think it's safe to say that they beat their own expectations, or their own guidance, rather, and almost all of Wall Street's expectations. The numbers were phenomenal. Profits were up 7% from a year ago, with revenues of $45.6 billion. That was on a net profit of $10.2 billion. It was actually Apple's best non-holiday quarter ever, which I think surprised a lot of people. And surprisingly, the iPhone came out big time. It came out to be the big winner in the quarter. Apple actually sold 43.7 million iPhones. That was almost a 17% increase, 16.8% increase in sales over the year-ago quarter. And guess what? The Mac didn't do too shabby either, despite the fact that PC sales are down across the industry. Apple actually had a 4.7% increase in Mac sales over the year-ago quarter, selling 4.1 million units. iTunes sales also set a quarterly record, bringing in $4.7 billion. That was 11% increase over the year before. And specifically, the App Store, apps in the App Store accounted for $2.6 billion, and that was up 9% year over year. The App Store, as a matter of fact, generated 85% more revenue than the Google Play Store in the March quarter. Now, we got to get on to the bad news because there was a little bit of that. iPad and iPod sales, rather, were both down from last year. iPad sales dropped 16%, coming in at just 16.3 million units. And Apple sold 2.7 million iPods. That was down 51% year over year. I don't think it's too surprising that iPod sales are continuing to slow, and actually really slow drastically. Cook did try to put a positive spin on the iPad sales, saying they actually met with the high end of their own expectations for the quarter, and explained that comparing the numbers to last year wasn't a fair comparison because, for example, things like the iPad Mini, had a lot of orders that they weren't able to fulfill at the end of the year that they had to fulfill later, and those actually propped those numbers up. So overall, I think they felt they were really only about 3% down when you kind of compared apples to apples. The iPad is the fastest growing product in Apple's history still. They've sold over 210 million units to date, which is actually twice as many units as the iPhone did in the same time frame. So even though they're not selling as many as they were last year, they're still doing surprisingly well with the iPad. Among people planning to purchase tablets, they pointed out in the next 90 days, two-thirds of them have said they plan to buy an iPad, and the iPad has over 95% share of the U.S. education market. So they kind of focused on some of the highlights surrounding the iPad, trying to deflect maybe a little bit of the bad news that the overall sales numbers were down. And Chitika, actually, in their latest U.S. and Canadian web usage numbers, showed that the iPad accounted for a 77.2% share of the web traffic market in the U.S. and Canada. By comparison, Samsung tablets had just 8.3% of the web traffic. So people who are buying iPads are obviously surfing online. I'm not sure what's going on with all of those other tablets. One theory is that tablet users tend to use more apps, but I think any app that accesses the web, as far as I know, should show up in web usage numbers. So certainly the iPad, at least in North America, is still showing a very strong showing when it comes to actual usage of the device. And Cook was asked in the Q&A about Microsoft Office and what he thought if, you know, that finally making its way to the iPad was going to have any kind of impact. Apple has had really good traction in the enterprise already with the iPad, so I could only imagine that that's going to help. But Cook specifically said that Office to the iPad, coming to the iPad, will help iPad sales, but noted that it would have been better for Microsoft if they had done it sooner. So I don't know if that was a little dig or if, you know, he was just sort of empathizing with Microsoft's struggle and saying, hey, you know, if they had you brought it to the iPad sooner, you would have had more people, you know, buying and using Office on the iPad, and you could have generated some revenue from software sales. And it's something that I've mentioned on the show before, that I think Microsoft should just go back completely to focusing on Office. And I think I told you last time that I had good experience with Microsoft Office for the desktop support on my Mac, but I'm still not overly thrilled with Office and specifically Word on the Mac. But the iPad version, I tried it out because I'm now a 365 subscriber. The Office version, or the version of Office, or specifically Word on the iPad, is really good. I found it to be a really good experience, and I really think that Microsoft deserves some credit for building a nice touch-enabled version of Word, and I would dare say it might be able to hold its own against Apple's Pages, for iOS. I'm going to have to play around with them a little bit more. I don't have a firm opinion yet, so hold your emails and your comments. But I'd love to get your opinions as well. If you've been using the Office Suite on the iPad, what do you think? I think it's actually pretty good, and that's what we've been overall hearing in a lot of the reviews. But let's get back to the quarterly results call, some of the other numbers in there. The call definitely had a big focus on Apple's growth and success in international and emerging markets. As a matter of fact, international sales accounted for two-thirds, 66% of revenues. So Apple is making a lot more money internationally, bringing that into their bottom line. They pointed out that China Mobile had a significant impact on the iPhone sales. So, those iPhone numbers being so strong was really helped out by the international markets. iPhone sales in Japan were actually up 50% year over year. And in other countries, iPhone sales grew 61% in Brazil, 97% in Russia, 56% in Turkey, 55% in India, and a whopping 262% in Vietnam. A lot of those strong sales internationally and especially in emerging markets were attributed to the iPhone 4S. And the good thing about all of that is it's bringing new customers into the Apple ecosystem. And Apple knows that when they have new customers, customers tend to get locked in. They tend to stick with Apple products moving forward. So anytime they can gain new subscribers and new people in the Apple ecosystem, that's really good. The halo effect is in full bore. And some other significant notes from the call, just over two-thirds of people registering the iPad were new to the platform in the quarter, and over half the iPhone users were new to the iPhone. So again, bringing long-term benefit with respect to that halo effect, and that will happen on both the products and the services level. I think that's why we're also seeing the numbers for the iTunes Store and the App Store numbers really going up, is as Apple brings more new customers into the ecosystem, it's really good across the entire company. It's good for Apple as a whole. And further reinforcing that, they noted that 85% of iPhone 4S buyers were new to the iPhone, and 62% of iPhone 4S buyers and 60% of iPhone 5C buyers were switching from Android. And a lot of people have been bashing on the iPhone 5C, saying that it wasn't as successful for Apple as Apple was hoping. But I think in this call, it sort of showed it's doing exactly what I thought it should be doing, which is bringing in new customers, bringing in converts from other platforms. It's that entry-level iPhone that if you were buying a free or a cheap Android phone and you're looking to switch, it's probably the one that you're going to move into. And once again, once you have that Apple experience, you're probably going to stick with it. So I think Apple's going to see and has already been seeing an upselling when a person goes to upgrade from a 4 or a 4S or a 5C, they're going to move them to the higher priced and higher profit premium phones. And again, that's really good for Apple's overall health going forward. Apple now has over 800 million registered iTunes accounts, and they made it very clear in pointing out once again that most of those accounts are tied with credit cards. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later when we talk about some of the payment system rumors that are floating around Apple. But and those kinds of numbers are important for that kind of thing to be successful. And Cook also expressed excitement about what Apple is currently working on, alluding to in releasing new products, or when Apple will release new products. He said it's, quote, closer than it's ever been. So they're getting ready to announce new stuff. Again, I don't think that's that surprising to us, to those of us who are following closely. We're expecting, once again, as I mentioned last time, a big Apple Barf Fest of new products coming in the fall. There's going to be tons and tons of things for us to spend our money on. So save up your pennies. And one of those things might be Apple TV updates. Specifically during the QA, Gene Munster asked again about the Apple TV, and no, Gene, there's not going to be an Apple television. I think he keeps asking the questions about Apple TV because he's one of those people, like our friend Victor Cahiao, who is firmly entrenched in believing that Apple at some point is going to put out an Apple television set. But he specifically asked why Apple no longer considers the Apple TV to be a hobby. And it's not because they're going to bring out a television. As Cook explained, it's because when a product makes over $1 billion, he figures that it's no longer time to call it a hobby. So, you know, once it crossed that threshold of bringing in more than $1 billion in revenue to the company, it was like, that's not a hobby anymore. And he did note that Apple has to date sold over 20 million Apple TV units. I think we're going to see an update to the Apple TV. We've talked about that a little bit. Probably some game controller kind of stuff in there. There's been rumors of maybe motion controller, maybe Siri integration. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But those were kind of the highlights and some of the updates from Apple's earnings results call. What did you think? I thought it was huge and impressive, and we didn't even get into the stock stuff. Apple announced that they're going to be doing a 7-to-1 stock split. They're going to be doing more on their stock buyback program. I think they increased that by like $30 million in the stock buybacks, and that helped with those two things. Really helped with the price of Apple's stock. I was looking today, and it's almost up around 600, or was approaching 600. So back at an all-time high for the year. So that's good news all the way around for Apple. Wall Street was obviously very excited about what was going on. Last week, we talked about the rumor that Nike had dismissed 70 to 80% of its Fuel Band hardware team. There's some new information that came out over the past week regarding that, specifically a response from Nike. They said that they are going to lay off a small number of the team, but it's not nowhere near the 70 to 80% that was reported. I dug into this a little bit, and I think there might be some confusion on what we were talking about. The total team apparently is around 200 people at the moment, and reportedly about 70 of those work on the hardware team. This is according to CNET. And reportedly, 55 people in the hardware team are being let go. So that would be about 78% of the hardware team, but of the overall entire Fuel Band team, that accounts at about 28%. So still significant. Nike didn't really clarify what a quote-unquote small number of the team was. So, you know, I think it's all up to interpretation, depending upon whose perspective you kind of want to take. But the point is that Nike did say that the Nike Plus Fuel Band SE remains an important part of their business, and that they do plan to improve upon the Nike Plus Fuel Band app, as well as launch new version of the Fuel Band with new colors, and that they're going to support the Fuel Band into the near future. But you might be asking yourself at this point, why are we even talking about Nike on an Apple podcast? And the answer is there are a lot of rumors that Apple and Nike might be working together. And the reason this story even got any kind of buzz in our community was the fact that Nike and Apple have worked together in the past, and they could be working on something in the future, something related to Apple's iWatch project. Tim Cook has mentioned the Nike Fuel Band in talks. He did that at the D conference. He even wears a Nike Fuel Band, so we know he's a fan. He sits on Nike's board of directors. He also commented that Apple has done a lot of research kind of in this field, and specifically, I think, kind of the watch field, and said, you know, people just don't wear watches, especially young people these days. It's not something that they wear on their wrist. So while they find wearables interesting, I'm not so convinced that it's going to be a watch. I mean, we've talked about this on the show in the past, right? We call it the iWatch just to have kind of a name, something that we can glom onto to talk about. But I think we might be looking more at a kind of wearable, I don't know if we call it a system or what the proper term for it is. It may be just a band. It's going to have the ability to tell the time. So I guess if you want to call that a watch, or I believe it's going to have the ability to tell the time, if you want to, you know, say that's a watch, then fine. But I think it's going to be a whole lot more. And since the Nike rumor, we've been hearing a lot about the health and fitness implications of whatever project or product Apple is working on. And I feel pretty strongly it's going to have this big health and fitness element. And I think one of the reasons Apple is pushing it in that direction is because we've seen a lot of people buying and actually wearing these kinds of devices. It is something that someone would put on their wrist. And I think Apple's going to take that to the next level and give a broader spectrum of consumers a reason to buy the product and wear it. And the key to all this with respect to Apple is they're going to be able to do what they always do, which is tightly integrate the hardware and software and make the experience amazing. We've already heard rumors about a health book app that's going to kind of consolidate all of the data and the sensor information. And so if you start thinking about this health application, it kind of makes sense that Apple might turn to Nike to help out. So I buy the rumors from that perspective, but then I also think about the fact that it's really not in Apple's DNA to partner up with people all that often. I mean, they've done it with the Nike, with the iPod in the past, but that was a really kind of loosely coupled integration. Really, Apple wants to typically control the entire experience. They don't want to just control one half of it, like say, we're going to do the hardware, we'll let you do the software and apps. They're going to want some sort of app. So I was trying to think, how does this work? Does Apple actually license Nike technology and integrate it with their own apps and hardware? They could actually say, look, we're going to integrate some hooks so that you can work with some of Nike. You know, this thing will work with some of your apps, but we're going to have our own app as well and our own sort of solutions for integrating with the hardware. That could be nice because it could let the customer have the benefit of getting some features and experience through Apple's built-in software, as well as enhancing the experience if they want to sort of buy into the Nike ecosystem. It also could be possible that Apple's iWatch would integrate with Nike software so that it can operate on other platforms. And when I started thinking about that, that got to be really interesting to me. And I think that might be what this whole relationship is about, because Apple's going to do their own thing on iOS. They're going to have it tightly integrated with their devices. But I think for a kind of consumer product, something like an iWatch or Band or whatever it is, you're going to want to sell that not just into the Apple ecosystem, but also into the broader ecosystem. Anybody who has kind of connected devices. And you might say, well, that's, again, not in Apple's DNA to kind of do that thing. But they did in a way with the iPod, right? The iPod worked with PCs, but the hook was that if you were in the Apple ecosystem, if you had a Mac, your experience was better. It was enhanced by being on that platform. So I think it's going to have a broader appeal, but I think it's going to have the best experience on the Mac and with the iPhone and with your iOS devices, and that's going to be how Apple's going to slowly win people over. They're going to put out a great device and product that works as standalone. It might have some integration maybe with some of the stuff that Nike is doing on the software side, and then be even greater on the Apple platform. Again, it's going to be much more than a watch. The question is it going to be a band form factor? You know, so just sort of like a, almost look like a bracelet, or is it going to actually be like a watch, something that looks like a watch? We know Apple's hired a bunch of industry professionals who would have design experience in the fashion industry. So that kind of pushes it more towards that watch form factor. And this last week, allegedly, Apple's been using this shell company, a company called Brightflash, to file for trademark registration for the term iWatch. So I think it could end up being called an iWatch, but I'm taking that with a grain of salt and thinking about it very, very loosely. It's odd, you know, what's odd about the rumor about the trademark registration is that Apple did apply for several iWatch trademarks under its own name as well in different countries. So it's not just that they're using kind of like this shell company. And I think at the end of all of this, really the sensors are the key to this device. I think it's going to have a lot of sensors. We've heard recently that Apple has just started going into production on the quote-unquote iWatch, and that it's going to have a whole integrated platform. So a lot of the sensors are going to be integrated into an entire chip package with the sensors all included inside of it so they can keep the device small. We've also had the latest rumors and mentions that there might be some gesture control in there. We know that Apple purchased PrimeSense, which helped develop some of the Kinect technology. We've also been hearing rumors about NFC being in the iWatch. The NFC thing still throws me off every time you hear that rumor, because I think Apple really doesn't have interest in doing NFC, at least not in the traditional way that most of us think about NFC. I think really Apple's going to go with the kind of payment platform that they have in their stores, and it's going to be something tied to your iTunes account. So let's talk about that a little bit too, because we've been hearing all these rumors about mobile payments and Apple. I really think that Apple is going to do something. And as a matter of fact, this past week, Recode said that Apple was hiring some senior level people to help negotiate and build out an iTunes backed mobile payment business. And I think that is going to be the way that they go. I think it's going to be something coupled with Touch ID and probably some kind of technology more like iBeacons, something like that, using low energy Bluetooth, not having to rely on a special like NFC sort of chip. and I will be able to go and pay at retailers with my iTunes account. So what I really like about that system is that I only have to have my payment information with Apple. They kind of hold it, and I don't have to worry about my data being in other data centers, things like that. And again, if you bring this back to the quarterly results call, Tim Cook pointed out that Apple has a ton of people already using Touch ID to authenticate. And he mentioned those things about having that 800 million iTunes accounts with credit cards. And he also talked about people buying stuff with Touch ID in the App Store, getting people familiar with that process. I think Apple rolled out Touch ID and they rolled that into the App Store buying experience to get customers and people comfortable with using that method of payment. And I think that's going to tie into some sort of physical in-store payment system in the future. And I think that's something that's going to have a lot more traction than NFC, especially in the States. I know outside the U.S., for at least micropayment kind of things, some countries have that kind of touch. You know, you touch your phone or device or use some sort of NFC to pay. We have that here, as a matter of fact. I mean, there's a lot of credit card terminals that have, I think it's called PayLink or something like that. I have never used it. I've never seen anybody use it. I tried to use it one time, and the retailer told me not to use it. He said, oh, it doesn't really work. So it's always been really discouraged and as sort of a payment system. And I think about how I use my Starbucks, you know, payment, my card or my phone, just by scanning that little barcode or having them scan the barcode. And that's getting more and more common and prevalent. So if you can take the barcode mechanism out of it and still make the payment, so if I can walk up to an iBeacon, for example, and it recognizes that I'm near it and says, hey, would you like to pay with your iTunes account? And I just press my finger on my Touch ID sensor, or better yet, if I just happen to have my iWatch on, and it authenticates some way that way. Maybe there's a sensor on the iWatch or the band that I can touch that'll read my fingerprint like a Touch ID, and then I pay. I'm always going to have that on my wrist. I'm always going to have that with me. It also gives people an excuse to always wear their wristband, which has added benefits for the health and fitness tracking and stuff like that. So if you can get people wearing something and give them a reason to want to wear something on their wrist, then I think Apple's going to have a real winner. And I think there's going to be a lot of motivational elements in whatever product Apple comes out with as a wearable for multiple different types of people, because not everybody's going to be into the fitness thing, not everybody's going to be into the payments thing, and there's going to be some other hooks and functionality as well that are going to provide benefits to really make us want to do that. And that's Apple's expertise, right? They bring out products that we didn't know we needed, but once we have them, they're products that we can't live without. And that's really what this is going to be all about. Have some software updates and things to talk about with you. iOS 7.1.1 was released. It brings further improvements to Touch ID and Touch ID recognition, although, frankly, I have never had too many issues with Touch ID, but I know a lot of people have, so I'm curious to know if this update has fixed any Touch ID bugginess or issues for you. It supposedly fixes keyboard responsiveness, so the keyboard's supposed to be a little bit quicker. Again, this was another area where I didn't run into too many issues with my phone, but maybe that was something on older devices, and fixes an issue with Bluetooth keyboards when VoiceOver is enabled. Adrian Kingsley Hughes over at ZDNet seems to think also that the 7.1.1 update brought big battery life improvements. I have had some battery life issues with iOS 7, but I also recognize the fact that I have a Pebble, which connects with the Bluetooth and does a lot of data transmission back and forth for notifications and things like that. I also have been using an app that taps into the GPS functionality on my phone. So I feel like I really can't trust the battery on my phone. I'm still getting more than a full day's worth of usage out of it, but it did seem to drain a little bit more quickly. I haven't noticed any significant change since 7.1.1 came out, but then again, I haven't been using it for too long. Apple also did also release an update for the Apple TV, the second and third generation models, so the little black hockey puck style ones, or I guess square hockey puck would be a more accurate description. 6.1.1 is out. There were no details given as far as what is in the update, but we can assume that it's some things to bring it in line and up to date with also the updates that they released in iOS 7.1.1. One thing that was noticed is that in the hints for, or that there were some hints in the 7.1 update that show that there might be Siri support coming to the Apple TV. What I found curious about that rumor is that those hooks and those references were in the iOS version and not the Apple TV version, not the 6.1.1 update, but in the iOS 7.1.1 update. So typically we have seen situations where little updates and hooks will come into play in kind of the what I would consider to be the core and then get moved over into the other platform. So it could make sense. Siri, a lot of people think Siri support's going to come to an update of the Apple TV so that you'll be able to just ask Siri to bring up your programming and things like that, make it a little bit easier than having to use the remote control or to actually type in stuff, which I think would be a nice welcome update. The question would be, how is it going to listen? Is it going to have a little microphone on the Apple TV? Is it going to do it through your iPhone? Is there going to be some sort of new remote with a little microphone integration? Not really sure how Apple will approach that. My guess is it would be something maybe built into the remote and you press a button and then Siri will start to listen and you can talk into it. But I'm just purely riffing and speculating at this point. There were also code hints in the 7.1.1 update or the 7.1 update hinting that Touch ID might be coming to an iPad soon. That to me just seems really obvious. I think Apple's going to do Touch ID across the board on iOS. So I fully expect all the next generations of the iPad Mini, and the iPad Air to have Touch ID sensors integrated into them. And it makes sense that Apple would be testing those things out and starting to roll that into the software. There was also a security update for Mac OS X, update 2014-002, so that marks the second security update for Mac OS X. It fixes an issue that could cause the search and address field to load a web page or send a search term before hitting the return key, fixed an issue that could block the receipt of push notifications from some websites, also added a preference to turn off push notification prompts from websites, so I immediately went and hit that because I really don't want push notifications from websites. I'm always hitting no, so now you'll be able to just ignore those and not have to worry about it. Strengthens Safari sandboxing, also fixes security issues, including several identified by recent security competitions. So Apple is patching up security holes. And if you haven't upgraded to Safari 7.0.3 yet, if you run the security update, you're going to get updated to 7.0.3. That update actually came out on April 1st, and you should have patched that up because you want to keep up to date with your security patches on Safari. But if you haven't done it yet, the security update for Mac OS X is going to bring you up to date on your Safari. And if you've been having FaceTime issues with your iOS device, Apple doesn't have an update, but they have a fix, and you may or may not like it depending upon which version of the operating system you want to run. Specifically, if your device is running iOS 6, Apple says if you want to fix it up, you're going to need to update to iOS 7 if your device supports it. Apple put out a tech info article this past week and claim that they are aware of an issue that comes from a bug resulting from an expired device certificate. It makes FaceTime unusable on older versions of iOS, and really the only solution to the problem is to update to the latest version of the operating system. That means that if your device is capable of running iOS 7, you need to upgrade it to iOS 7.0.4 or later. I know a number of you have held off just because you don't like the look of iOS 7, so you're going to have to make a choice. Do you want your FaceTime to work, or do you want to stay on iOS 6? And then if your device can't run iOS 7, you do need to update to 6.1.6 to get the fix. Now, I don't know how Apple is making it so that if you have a device that runs 7, but you're running 6.1.6, it doesn't fix this issue. Baffling to me, but just wanted to make you aware of that, and I know it's going to frustrate some of you. Apple also did something really unusual this past week. It's going to let any of us who want run the beta versions of Mavericks, at least if you want to sign up for the program. Apple opened up the OS X Mavericks beta seed program to any and all comers. All you have to do is go to Apple's OS X beta seed program website and sign up. Say, hey, I want to be a beta tester. I want to test out future updates of Mac OS X before anybody else. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. It used to be that you had to be an actual a developer. You had to be in Apple's Mac OS X developer program and pay your $100 a year to get these. Now anyone can do it. But I'm going to warn you and tell you that I think it's a really bad idea for most people. You really only want to do this if you really want to be a beta tester, if you want to put yourself through all the pain and anguish of your apps not working, things crashing and breaking, and all that sort of stuff. If you absolutely have to have OS X, the next version of OS X, before everybody else, maybe you're in that group, but I'm certainly not going to sign up. I do not like to run beta versions, at least not early beta versions, of Apple software on any of my devices or my Macs. As a matter of fact, I'm in the iOS development program, and I usually wait until they're one or two versions away from release before I even try that on my iOS devices. And I consider it a little bit less risky on iOS. They tend to be a little bit more stable, and the apps seem to come along a little bit better. And frankly, my iOS devices still aren't as critical for my day-to-day work as my desktop machines. But if you have a desktop machine and you're using it for any kind of real work, I would really advise you to not sign up for the Beta Seed program. But wanted to point out that it is opened up, and you can get in there and sign up if you'd like to, if you'd like to be a beta tester. And then finally, Apple has issued a recall on iPhone 5s, at least some iPhone 5s that have sleep-wake button issues. They started up a sleep-wake button recall replacement program. Apple says it affects a quote-unquote small number of iPhone models where the sleep-wake button could fail. I actually had this happen on my iPhone 5 really early on, and I just took it into the Apple store and they replaced it. But what they're doing now under this program is you're going to have to take in your device or send it into Apple, and they're going to have to keep it because they're going to actually do a repair. Now, the article I read said that some Apple stores are providing loaner phones, so if you can't live without your iPhone while it's being repaired, they might give you a loaner. But be prepared if you're going to go in. You can go on the website, by the way, and put in your serial number, I think, and it will verify whether or not you have one of the affected iPhone 5s. And so not every iPhone 5 is going to need to go in. So I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. You can check your phone out, see if you need to do it. iMore also said something interesting. They said if you go in and you are impacted and you want to get a new phone, Apple is giving you $80 more on the trade-in than they normally would. So you can get $350 credit toward buying a new phone rather than having them replace the sleep-wake button in your affected iPhone 5. Now, according to iMore, employees aren't just offering that up. If you come in, you actually have to ask for that program or ask to get that credit. And I would also say, don't forget, the iPhone 6 is just around the corner. So you can get a trade-in offer when the iPhone 6 comes out. I don't know if it'll be as good as this one is now, but if you really want the latest and greatest, we're expecting iPhone 6 in the fall. So you've got to kind of make a judgment call on there. Do you want to upgrade to an iPhone 5S now and get a $350 credit, or do you just want to hold off and wait? But thought I'd point out that program because I found that very interesting. And, you know, it's 80 bucks more, so that's a significant savings. And speaking of the iPhone 6, let's talk about some of the latest crazy rumors surrounding that. The Commercial Times is reporting that there is a 5.5-inch version of the iPhone 6. That's the one that's supposed to be the bigger version of the 4.7-inch model, which is the one that's supposed to be out in the fall, and we're supposed to get the 5.5 sometime later. And they're saying, well, the 5.5 is not coming because they're having delays due to yield issues with the battery components. Apple wants the 5.5-inch model reportedly to be as thin as it possibly can, meaning that they want a 2-millimeter thick battery, according to the report. Normally, batteries, I guess, are closer to 3 millimeters. And because of that, Apple is having yield issues. And as soon as they can resolve that problem, then they will release a new version of the device, or the other version of the device, I guess I should say. And they're pointing at the first quarter, sometime early in 2015, as the point when Apple is going to release the 5.5-inch model of the iPhone. Again, I think this is completely crazy. I don't think Apple's going to put out two different versions of the iPhone 6 within a year. I think Apple is going to stick with their fall release schedule. I think they're going to release one form factor of the device. As far as where the rumors and all this craziness is coming from, I think what's going on is Apple is always evaluating different models and sizes as they move in and try and figure out what they're going to produce for that year. So I think they've been evaluating different screen sizes, different form factors, thicknesses and thinnesses, different kinds of components, talking with suppliers and manufacturers. We know they talk to multiple suppliers and are sort of working out contracts and deals and seeing who can give them the best components at the best price, at the best yields. All those sorts of things are going on. And I think they get all that information early on and they figure out which components and schedules and deals and yields and timelines can fit together to build the best possible product that they can for their launch schedule, which we now know is the fall right before the holiday selling season. And I think where they've landed based on all the rumors I've been reading and hearing is with the 4.7-inch form factor. It's going to be wider, bigger screen, all those things we've been hearing about. Probably will have the power button on the side, the sleep wake button on the side, like we've seen some of the leaked case components. But the fact that they're going to do two different sizes, I think that is not there. Some of the other sort of late breaking rumors we heard this past week too, Mac Atakahara claimed that the iPhone 6 is going to have a curved glass display and an all aluminum rear shell. I believe the rear shell, the curved display that they're talking about is that you would have a display that would sort of folded over or wrapped around the edge a little bit, kind of giving it a nice beveled edge. A couple people quickly went and did some sort of mock-ups based on the rumor, and I have to say it looks like it would be a really cool-looking device. I don't know if we'll see it sort of going flush into a metal bezel or actually see the glass kind of curving a little bit. A lot of people have been throwing out that rumor that Apple is going to go with a curved glass display. The thing is with the sapphire glass that they want to produce or that we've been hearing, you know, heavy rumors about, I think that's going to be really tricky to do. So I'm fully expecting it to still be a flat glass display with a metal casing. The metal casing is rumored to be thinner, 10 to 20% thinner, according to KGI securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. So that's going to result in, obviously, a thinner iPhone. I think this next generation iPhone, because we've heard it so many times in the rumors, is going to be super, super thin. And we're hearing something like, you know, basically the same thickness as the iPod Touch, about that, I think it's about 6 millimeter range, which is really, really thin. And Weibo, the Chinese site, is saying that Apple has decided to dump the optical image stabilization in the camera that we've been hearing about, because they want to keep the sensor flush with the device. And because it's so thin, we had been hearing that there might be that little sort of camera bump like you have on the iPod Touch where it sticks out a little bit. And one of the reasons for that would have been that Apple wanted to get some optical image stabilization into the iPhone. They're saying that's gone now and that Apple has opted to go with a larger pixel size in the sensor, which will result in better image quality. I also think it helps with the low light so they can get better low light quality, but they're going to stick with doing a digital image stabilization, which, that's okay. I have shaky hands, so I was really looking forward to having an optical stabilizer in there, but I think I'd rather have the lens flush with the device for the look and finish and forego that sort of thing if that's what they have to do. But that's the latest rumors that we have on the iPhone 6. And then finally in the news for today, new MacBook Airs. Apple did release new MacBook Airs just this morning. It's a slight update, nothing really major to the 11-inch and the 13-inch MacBook Airs. Updated Intel processors, all models now feature a 1.4 gigahertz dual-core Intel i5 processor with Turbo Boost up to 2.7 gigahertz and 4 gigabytes of RAM to start. That's on both the 11-inch 128 and 256 gigabyte models, as well as the 13-inch models. All of the other specs do seem to remain the same, but the other significant update is they're all $100 less. So you can save $100 and get a little bit of better processor to boot. And the 11-inch 128 gigabyte model now starts at $899 US, and the build-to-order configurations now top out at 1.8 gigahertz, a dual-core Intel i7 processor with up to 8 gigabytes of RAM. And there was no sign of the rumored 12-inch MacBook Air with Retina display. So still don't have the Retina displays in the MacBook Airs, but you can get them for $100 off and get a little more oomph in your processor. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now let's talk about something that I mentioned on the last MacCast. That's actually a little tip, something that I discovered that can help actually deal with the spinning beach ball of death if you're getting that in some applications. And I actually ran across this because I had a little bit of trouble with my transporter software. But what I discovered is that there's a thing in your Mac called the Dynamic Link Editor cache, the DYLD cache. And if that gets corrupted or messed up, it can cause all kinds of problems on your Mac, specifically with applications running. In my case, it was causing some issues with the Finder and sort of doing these random reboot things. And it was really annoying. And I gave out a terminal command that you can run to sort of clear out and free up that cache. But a lot of people don't like to open up terminal. You don't like typing in those command lines. And a bunch of you pointed out that the free tool Onyx, which is great for just doing general maintenance on your Mac, can actually clear out that dynamic link editor cache. It actually has an option for that. So I'll have a link to Onyx in the show notes at maccast.com. I also then went and checked because my favorite OS X maintenance tool is Cocktail. It costs about $20 US. Onyx is free. But I like to use Cocktail, and it will do it as well. It has an option to clear out the dynamic link editor cache. So what you're looking for is DYLD cache in your favorite sort of maintenance utility app and see if it'll clean that out. And that way you don't have to get down there, down and dirty in the terminal. In my case, you know, that issue came from my transporter software, and I had a hard reboot. I guess what can also corrupt the DYLD is if you need to do a hard shutdown, that's where your Mac totally freezes up and you have to hold the power button. That can sometimes corrupt that. And if that link cache gets corrupted, then all kinds of spinning beach balls and things can happen. So if you've been experiencing that specifically with just like one app, it could just be that app's dynamic link cache that got messed up, you might give this little fix a try. Another thing we had discussed recently on the MacCast was doing spotlight searches. I don't remember how many episodes ago it was, but at one point I was covering different ways of doing searching and spotlight and maybe giving some spotlight search tips and things like that. And I guess I mentioned that in the Finder, when you're searching in the Finder, you go under the Finder, you go under the file menu rather and choose Find or use Command F, keyboard shortcut to bring up that little search window. For me, it always seemed to default to searching this Mac. And that's sort of the first thing. When you bring up that window, you'll notice there's a little kind of search bar and it has different search locations. It has this Mac. It usually has the folder that you're currently in. And then it also has the shared location. And for me, typically, I want to search within the folder that I already have selected in the Finder. And I was explaining in that episode that you can, you know, click the location that you want to search, but it would be really nice if it would sort of default to the folder rather than this Mac. Well, it turns out that you can actually change that setting. You can adjust that behavior. Jamie wrote in to let me know that I had just missed a Finder preference. So in the Finder, if you go under Finder, the Finder menu, and choose Preferences, and then click on the Advanced tab, right there at the bottom, you can change the when performing a search setting. There's a little drop down, and you can change that to either default to search this Mac, search the current folder, meaning the current folder that you have selected when you initiate the search, or you can use the previous search scope. I take that to mean, and I haven't tested this fully yet, but I think that means that whichever item you had picked last in that window. So when you click on the little tab, if you had last had search this Mac selected, that's what it's going to default to. If you had the specific folder selected, it's going to default to that selected folder. And I actually, that third method is what I put mine on, because that way I can kind of toggle it back and forth as need be, but it's always going to default to the last thing that I was sort of searching on. So thank you, Jamie, for sending that in, and I don't know how I missed that one. You know, too, if you listened last week, that I had already kind of gotten sick of hearing about Heartbleed, the SSL exploit that hit the internet. And granted, it's a very important thing to know about. You should be aware of it, and you should be changing your passwords and taking precautions to protect yourself. But it had been making the rounds and making the rounds, and it kept kind of cropping up in the news, sort of dominated the news last week. Well, guess what? We got to bring it back up this week, because when the announcement of the Heartbleed vulnerability came out, Apple made a specific point of responding and saying that iOS and OS X never incorporated the vulnerable software, and that their key web-based services, things like iCloud, were not affected by the bug. And then, curiously, this last week, they released a patch for the 2013 Airport Extreme base stations. I think also the time capsules, you know, the tall, sort of towerish style ones that Apple are the Apple's latest versions. And in the release notes for that, it said that it had security improvements related to TLS, and that's the exact area that was impacted by the Heartbleed vulnerability. Now, Mac Observer reported on this. I think Jeff Gamet did a report on this, and asked Apple to sort of respond and say, was this to address the Heartbleed OpenSSL bug, and did that affect airport base stations? And of course, he didn't hear from Apple at all. They never responded. So we don't really know. But the assumption is that that was to address that. Well, I went and thought I should do some digging, because I think if you license that technology, you sort of have to make note of it. So I fired up Airport Utility. And if you go under the Airport Utility menu, there is a acknowledgements selection. And if you choose that, then you get a text file that will open up that contains all the licensed technology related to airport. And OpenSSL is on the list. Now, it doesn't give any details as to what specific things Airport uses OpenSSL for, or which devices use it, or what versions implemented. You don't get that information, but I think we can make a logical deduction that definitely OpenSSL technology is used at least in some airport products based on the acknowledgements information that's in here. So what does all that mean? I don't know. It just means that, you know, Apple did not specifically in their statement say that airports weren't affected. They said iOS, OS X, their web-based services were not impacted by the Heartbleed bug. They didn't say all of our technology isn't affected by it, but I think they could have been a little more upfront and forthcoming. And I think it just, to me, sort of supports some of the critic theories that Apple isn't always as forthcoming or upfront about security stuff or their security stuff as they should be. As a matter of fact, also this week, Kristen Padgett, who worked on Apple's security team before she went to Tesla in 2014, wrote a blog post about the fact that, you know, Apple patched multiple WebKit vulnerabilities with the Safari update 7.0.3. And so they were fixed on OS X. But they didn't get fixed in iOS until the iOS 7 release this week, the 7.1.1 update. So there was like 3 weeks or longer of time where those vulnerabilities were exposed and made public through Apple's own sort of updates. And that exposes a bunch of people to some risks. And so she was kind of questioning, you know, why is Apple doing that? And when you see things like this, this Heartbleed thing, where they're not totally upfront about all their technologies that are impacted or potentially impacted by the bug, and just come out with a more public statement saying, hey, these things were not affected, it makes people feel safe or gives people a false sense of security. And I think across the board, not just Apple, but all other companies need to be a lot more transparent about security issues. There was another security issue this week that, again, illustrates how Apple doesn't really talk about these things. There was a security bug that was reported in Apple's Radar bug reporting system. It was actually more of a privacy thing, where a developer discovered that he could get full access to all of the contact information, addresses, email addresses, that sort of thing, for everybody in Apple's registered developer program, including anybody who had signed up for the free developer program, so just the Safari developer program. And he notified Apple, and they quietly patched the system over the weekend, but they didn't make any acknowledgement that potentially this data could have been stolen. I don't think that it was, and maybe they did their own internal researching and discovered that none of it was compromised before this guy reported the bug and it was patched. But still, it's, you know, kind of one of those things that Apple, I think, should be more proactive about. And I think that is good for all of us. It also sets a good example for the industry, because we've had other companies who've tried to sort of hide and patch and, you know, not really let consumers know that there were risks or that there was a potential problem. And I don't think that's the right way to behave. And I definitely don't think Apple should be continuing that trend. So hopefully they're going to be a little more open and transparent the more attention we call to the times when they aren't. And then I guess related to security, I should also mention just briefly this week that Adobe announced that there is a Flash zero-day exploit. It came out on Monday with Flash Player 13.0.0.201 and earlier on the Mac. So if you do use Flash, you want to make sure you update to the latest version from Adobe. And I don't know how that, you know, I only use Flash inside Chrome, which is baked into Chrome, and that's how I get access to Flash content, because I don't want to install that on my computer. So I'm assuming that there will be a web update for Chrome from Google, hopefully at some point if it's not out already. And you'll probably want to update that as well, just to make sure that it doesn't have the unpatched version of Flash Player in it. Maybe Chrome even already is up to date. I'm not really sure on that one. Dan emailed me this week, and he was having a bit of trouble with his scanner. Actually, he was scanning in some documents, scanning them into PDF, and I think it was must have been a ScanSnap or some sort of auto-feeding scanner. And he ended up getting some paper jams during the scanning, and at the end of the whole session, ended up with multiple files, some of them out of order. And he emailed me and was asking, do I know a free way to reorder and merge and combine the PDFs into a single document? And of course, my first answer back was, well, you could save yourself a lot of hassle by buying a copy of PDF Pen from Smile. And you know Smile is a MacCast sponsor, but I would actually be saying this regardless because it is an awesome app. I really believe that everybody who has to work with PDFs at all should just own a copy of PDF Pen. But it's a $60 investment, you know, $59.95, I think, for PDF Pen. And so for like a one-off instance where you just need to merge some PDFs together, that might be a little bit expensive. The thing is I found that now that I own it, I use it over and over again for all kinds of PDF jobs. Specifically, I use it a lot for filling in fake forms and signing documents and keeping myself paperless. Now, that said, Dan was really looking for a free solution, and there actually is a way to do it, and it's right there on your Mac. It's very easy to actually merge PDFs with Preview if you know what you're doing, because there's kind of a little trick you have to know about, and it's not really clear. It catches me off guard all the time when I try and do this. And so what you can do is you can open up the PDF documents with Preview. If you don't want your original PDF that you're merging into to be updated in place, in other words, if you want to keep the individual document, you probably want to make a copy of it before you open it up. So open up the kind of sort what I'm going to call the source document, the document that you want to merge the pages into, and then open up your other documents in other windows. So make sure you have each one in a separate preview window. I think that works easiest because, you know, if you grab and open a bunch of PDFs all at the same time, they'll open up in what looks like a single PDF document, but it's actually multiple documents all just kind of not mushed together, you know, not put together yet, but actually open up as in one window. Preview kind of works like that. But get them open up in separate documents, and then make sure that you have the view thumbnails option on. So either click the little button in the toolbar or go into the view menu and choose thumbnail view so that you have the thumbnails over there on the left. And then this is the important part. What you want to do is you want to drag the thumbnail from the document that you want to combine from on top of the thumbnail that you want to combine that page into. So grab the one from, drop it right on top of the page you want to, the document you want to merge it into, the thumbnail. And you'll know you have it right when you see the little green plus icon appear before you drop the page. And then when you drop it, it will be merged into that single document. And if you drop the page and you see a little light gray line between the page on top and the one underneath it in the thumbnail view, then you know you didn't do it right because you have two separate files. You need to make sure that you don't see that little gray line in the thumbnail view. You want to drag it right on top of that other page. And then once you've confirmed that you've done that, you can continue combining up, you know, pages, as many pages as you want. And then you can also drag the thumbnails around and reorder them in the destination document. And then once you have it in the right order, you have all the pages merged together, then you can just simply do a save and save the document, and then you should have all your pages merged together and in the order that you want them. Now, once I do this, I always quit preview and then go to the Finder, go to the merged document in the Finder, and just do a quick look, you know, so select it, hit the space bar, and just double check and make sure that all those pages actually did get merged together and everything looks the way you want it. But once you've confirmed that, then you know you have your document merged, and that's as simple as it is. It is really pretty straightforward. Again, the trick is just making sure that you merge the files with that little plus, the green plus icon, versus just putting them all kind of into the same preview window. And Apple makes that really confusing. I don't know why they just don't let it, the default method, be actually merging, because I think in most cases that's what people want to do when they're using that thumbnail view and just combining documents together. But there you have it, Dan. That should allow you to merge your PDFs together and do it for free on your Mac. Now let's talk a little bit about cord cutting, about getting rid of your cable television, any kind of subscription television, satellite, what have you, and just going purely digital. And the reason we're talking about this is actually Mike emailed me, and he asked me, what would it take for me to actually cut the cord to get rid of my broadcast television subscriptions? And Mike, the first thing I probably should say is that in many ways I actually already have, but I think to go 100% off of any kind of television is still pretty difficult for most people. And I'm going to try and explain why here in a minute, or at least my reasons why. And I'd love to hear some of yours as well. And if you have become a cord cutter, you know, what is working for you and maybe what isn't working for you so much. But I think it's still way too difficult. And I think that one of the very primary first reasons is that getting everything on a single device is really, really tricky. And of course, we're kind of talking about this because there's a lot of rumors that, you know, Apple's going to do something with the Apple TV. But the problem for television and the Apple TV and any kind of set-top box, be it Amazon's box or your Xbox or whatever you're using to get your content, is that there's just a lot of fragmentation. It really comes down to content, right? Can you get the content you want when and where you want it in a reasonable fashion? And for example, like HBO just announced, I think this past week, that they're doing a deal with Amazon. And so any HBO content that's, say, currently on something like Netflix, well, that's going to be going away. It's going to be Amazon exclusive. So if you want HBO shows that aren't HBO Go, this is totally separate from the whole HBO Go thing, right? Where you need to, if you want the latest and greatest stuff, if you want to watch your Game of Thrones current season, you need to subscribe to HBO and have cable, and you have to have your HBO Go subscription. So you're not cutting the cord there. But for cord cutting, for like older episodes, say something like, I don't know what other HBO shows are out there, Weeds or Mad Men, I can't remember which ones are on which cable service. But that's the problem, right? You're going to have different cable services doing deals with different places, Netflix or Amazon, and you end up with content in a bunch of different places. And that means then you have to have either different accounts or different boxes. If you want, you know, Hulu shows, you got to subscribe to Hulu and you got to pay for that. It almost becomes worse than just having the cable subscriptions, right? And you look at something like Apple TV, which keeps adding all of these great channels, and we get all really excited about them, right? They just added like the History Channel and I think A&E and stuff like that. But they're all locked into your cable subscription. You can't even get access to at least the live or most current content or maybe full episodes unless you do this really inane process. You pull it up on your Apple TV. I don't know if you've ever done this, but you pull up the channel on your Apple TV, and then you have to go to the settings, and it says, oh, subscribe. And you go there on the Apple TV, and you look, and then it gives you this URL. It says, well, you got to go to the website / subscribe, and you've got to verify your cable provider, and then it goes out and it checks and makes sure that you have a cable subscription that supports that channel. And oh, by the way, hopefully they've done a deal, that channel's done a deal with your cable subscriber, because, for example, and I think Mike even pointed out this problem to me, was that, say, for the History Channel, I have the History Channel on my cable package, right? But when I went to authorize it, they apparently hadn't done a deal with Cox, who is my cable provider. So they had Comcast and Time Warner and Cablevision and a bunch of other places, but Cox wasn't even listed as a provider. So I can't even get access to that content because I guess whatever deal needed to be in place didn't happen, right? So you've got that going on. Not all providers are supported, even when you want to subscribe, and you still have to tie it to your cable bill. And you know, then you've got fragmented and exclusive content, which we talked about a little bit. You have limited playback time for a lot of the network shows. So even if you jump through all the hoops that you want them, they want you to jump through, a lot of times for current content, it's only on there for a week or two after the original air date, and then it goes away. You've got a lot of pay-for-play channels coming. And again, if a certain box or service doesn't have the pay-for-play channel that you want to get access to, well, guess what? You are out of luck. And then forget about the whole live thing. I know this is a big deal for a lot of people, getting live service. And I can't remember, unfortunately, the name of the service that's in New York and Denver and a couple markets, but there is a service that was providing live television feeds for a fee. So you would subscribe, and it would be the same sorts of content you could get over the air if, say, you had an HD antenna. Well, they're getting sued or got sued in New York, and it's all up in the air whether even what they're doing is legal. But, you know, you could pay for their service and subscribe for an app and get live content. Personally, I don't watch live content. I haven't watched live content in probably 5 or more years, with the exception of maybe sports on occasion. And I get that sports are probably a key. You have to have live capability for sports, especially local sports. If you're following your local team, you can get those subscription services, like you can get the MLB service or the NBA service, but they're very, very expensive. The season pass kind of things is what I'm talking about, right? But several hundred dollars, and you really have to be a big sports fan. But what if you just want to get your kind of local sports stuff? You can't really do that on any of the set-top box services, at least not that I'm aware of, and certainly not on Apple TV. And then again, you have kind of exclusive deals. So we can get MLB if you want to pay for the subscription service on your Apple TV, or NBA or NHL, but guess what? There's no NFL. So that's not really doable as well. But the live TV thing for me isn't really a showstopper. I guess news is another area where people probably want live content, but I think more and more people are moving online for their news, and you can kind of get a lot of the information that way. But live is a showstopper for some people in terms of cutting the cord. And so I'm looking at all this stuff, and it's just like, I can't cut the cord at this point because I just don't want to jump off. Now, I really have, because my cable subscription package that I do pay for is just the most basic one that I can get. It has very few channels. I think I get 29 channels, and because I live in San Diego, I think a good portion of them are Spanish language channels. So I have very limited in terms of actual cable subscription channels that I subscribe to. And the rest is all supplemented with things like Netflix or purchase content. And actually, in the short term, I think that the fact that this is so disjointed and so just messed up at the moment, I think it really does benefit Apple, actually, in a few ways, because I think people are going to turn more to the content that they can get and pay for. So things on iTunes like season passes. That's how I'm sort of supplementing those few shows that I want to watch and then I want to get quick access to. Even that can be difficult sometimes, though, because I'm watching Game of Thrones, and of course I'm a whole season behind, and it takes forever for it to show up on iTunes, but the minute it does, I go ahead and buy the whole season, so I can actually get the content I want most of the time when and where I want it. Again, with the season blocks and stuff like that, which are really annoying, most people wait. I know a few people go out and find it on BitTorrent or something like that, but I think a lot of us are just willing to wait to get the content we want. I also think that there's a lot of choice, and people will find other things to do or other things to watch. It's that whole path of least resistance. So I think part of the dilemma that they don't realize when they're, you know, not making the content available is that there is so much choice, and so much choice on the screen that you're already using. And I think that's really the key, and another reason why Apple benefits from this. So you're sitting there, you want to watch something, you can't find it on your iPad, say on Netflix, something like that. You're going to go look for some other content. You're either going to go buy something else on iTunes, maybe buy another movie or rent a movie, find another TV show, look for another TV show within the catalog of something that you already have, say like Netflix or Hulu, or hey, maybe I'll just give up and say, you know, I'm going to go play a game, or I'll buy a new game and I'll play that on my device, or I'm going to go just surf the web and check my email, or I'm going to watch something on YouTube or Vimeo, or hey, you know what, I'm just going to read a book or listen to a podcast or watch a podcast or listen to an audiobook. I mean, you have so many things right on that device that if they're not going to make available what you want to purchase or what you want to watch, if they're not going to give it to you, we'll just go find something else to do. And I think that's the dilemma they're in, and I think that's something that they're not thinking about. And again, I think Apple really benefits because they're selling all that different kind of content, right? They're going to sell you that book. They will sell you the movie. They will sell you the season pass of that TV show you want to watch. You can go download that podcast that you want to watch right there in iTunes. So, you know, as far as being able to totally cut the cord at this point, you know, I think I'm coming to the conclusion that in some ways you can, but I don't think it's in the same way that you were originally asking me about, Mike. I think really, if you're talking about can I cancel my cable and get all of the content that I want that is currently available with my cable TV subscription in other ways, I don't think we're there yet, at least not as conveniently. You still kind of need that thing to get some of the access, but I think if you're asking, can I cut the cable, can I cut the cord and still find ways to be entertained and not have to rely on having that cable subscription, I think absolutely yes. I think there's a lot of choice, and Apple enables a lot of those choices for me. So that's kind of where I, you know, came to a conclusion on it. I'd be curious to know what you think. Again, if you are a cord cutter, if you've found other ways to kind of do this, is it really replacing what you had before, or are you more like me? Are you the kind of person that you'll just find other content, you'll find other means of entertainment, other media, what have you, to kind of fill in the gaps for when you just want to relax and say, watch something or do something for pleasure? Here's a question that came in from Randy this week, and I found it pretty interesting. It was something I hadn't really thought about, but is something that probably affects a lot of us. Randy uses multiple user accounts on a single Mac, and if you have multiple members in your family all using the same Mac, you probably do this yourself. In Randy's case, his family members would all be logged in throughout the day, and you use fast user switching to kind of switch between accounts, but he also has the Mac set up to, after a period of inactivity, go to the lock screen to require the username and password of the current user to be able to log back in. I think that's a good security thing, especially on laptops and things like that. But even at home, you know, maybe you want to have it locked out in case of a break-in or something happens, right? You don't want anybody to just have unfettered access to your system. So to do that, it's pretty easy to set up. You go into System Preferences, you go into Security and Privacy, click on the General tab, and then you can check that Require Password, and then set a time interval. I have mine set to, I think, about 5 minutes, but you can have it go immediately. You know, so whenever the Mac basically goes to sleep, whenever the display goes to sleep, it is going to lock out the account. And that's great, that's fine and dandy, till you realize when you're using multiple users, not everybody in the family maybe necessarily knows everybody else's password. So if Randy's logged in, when that action happens, you're going to need Randy's username and password to be able to log back into the system, or get back into that screen. But actually, Apple has thought about that. So it's actually not really too bad. What happens is that there's a little switch user button that appears on that lock screen. So if that's not your account, you can click the little switch user account, it'll flip over, and it'll bring up the Mac OS X login screen, and then you can log in to your account. It'll show all the accounts, and then you can log in to the appropriate account. So that's fine, and while that's not horrible, when you think about it, that really requires a whole extra click, and us Mac users, we're really all about efficiency, right? You want to save clicks. So Randy's question was, is there a way to set up something so that when a period of inactivity happens, instead of going to just the lock screen for the account or just locking to the account that's currently logged in, can it just go straight to that login screen, skipping that extra step of having to click on the switch user thing? And while it might seem trivial, if this is happening a lot throughout the day where different users are coming up to use the Mac and having to do that, that's a lot of inefficiency. So I started thinking about this and thinking, well, what are some ways that you could potentially handle this? And one way is there is another option on the Mac to set up in security and privacy the ability for the account to be auto-logged out after a period of inactivity. So if you go into system preferences, back into the security and privacy system preferences, you'll have to authenticate with an admin account by clicking the little lock. And then once you've done that, you can click on the advanced button in security and privacy. And within there, what you'll see is a checkbox that says log out after, and then you can set a period of inactivity there. So after a certain number of minutes, maybe 30 minutes, something like that, it will automatically log out of the account. Now, the issue with this method is that any open applications will also be shut down. But since in macOS 10 Mavericks now, it will remember the apps that were open and restore everything back to the way it was when you log back in, that may or may not be such of a problem. But it is, again, still a little less convenient than just using the simple fast user switching thing or going straight to the login screen. So another thing that I thought about is from the fast user switching menu, there is an option that you can select from that menu to go straight to the login window. And I probably should cover how to enable fast user switching for those of you who don't know how. So if you have multiple user accounts and you want to switch quickly between both of them, you can go into the system preferences, you can go into users and groups. Again, you're going to have to click the lock and authenticate to make changes, but do that, enter an admin username and password, and then click on the login options. From there, you can check the Show Fast User Switching menu as option and then select the kind of menu you want to appear in the menu bar. And you can display the full name, the account name, or just a simple little icon. And then now you'll have an icon or a name in your menu bar, and you can click on that and you'll get a bunch of the fast user switching options. And one of those options in the menu bar is to go straight to the logout window. So you can do that, or to the login window, rather. So you can do that. You select it, and the screen will go straight to the login window, leaving your account open and running in the background. And then another person can log in and use the computer. The problem here is that it would require someone to do that manually before they walked away from Mac, and people aren't really going to remember that sort of thing, right? So it's really, again, not an ideal situation or solution for what Randy is looking for. So then I discovered there actually is a terminal command that you can run to go straight to the login screen. And I will have it in the show notes at maccast.com. It's pretty long. Basically, what you have to do is you have to suspend the session. And you can, once you've done that, your Mac will automatically go to the login window. And I thought, well, hey, maybe here's a solution. Maybe if there's some way to trigger this command to auto-run after a period of inactivity, we'll have solved this problem. And there used to be a screensaver actually called Script Saver that could run Apple scripts on your Mac when it went to sleep. Unfortunately, it hasn't been updated in 2 years. So I don't think you're going to want to run it, even if it would work on OS X Mavericks. I found another application after doing some Google search called DSSW Power Manager, and it can do all sorts of things. It's really designed for power management, I think, in sort of high-end like corporate situations, so you can really cut back on your electricity bills and things like that with your computers. But one of its features is it can also trigger scripts on going to sleep. It costs $49 US, so it may be a little bit of overkill for this application, but I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, because if you need that sort of thing, it could work. There was also a sleep daemon, a daemon application called Sleep Watcher, but you have to know Unix pretty well to kind of set it up, and you're going to have to know how to write shell scripts and things like that. Again, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com for those of you who aren't that timid about getting into the command line. But again, Randy, for you, I don't know that this is going to be the ideal situation. So finally, after a lot of searching, what I found was an application called Event Scripts, and it's available in the Mac App Store. It's $3.99 US, and it can assign shell or Apple scripts to run on many different kinds of events. And there's all kinds of different events you can have trigger it, and there's a big list on their website. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it includes events for things like sleeping. Did the screen go to sleep? Did the screen wake up? Did the screen go to password lock? Did the screen go to password unlocked? And so what I did was I took that script, that little terminal command, and wrote a shell script. You could also bake it into an Apple script. And then because of macOS 10 sandboxing, you have to actually copy the script to a special location. So you go to Home, Library, Application Support, and there is a folder for event scripts that you can put in there, and that gives it the permission to actually run that script. And once you have it in there, then you can go into the application and you can set it up to automatically trigger based on one of those events. So I did a little playing around with this, and I set it up to trigger on the did the screen sleep, so that when the screen went to sleep, it would actually trigger the script to run and kill the session and then go to the login window. And it worked beautifully. It worked really, really well. You'll also want to go in and make sure that you disable the require password on security and privacy, the original setting that you had set up, Randy, because when I had both of them set, what happened was it went to the login window, which is exactly what I wanted, but after logging in, it went back to the last user's username and or password. It wanted to prompt for the actual password for the last logged in user. So you're going to have to use one or the other. But if you use the event scripts, you can get it to do the thing you want, go straight to the login window after a period of inactivity. So I think that's going to work for you. It definitely worked in my testing. If you happen to know a better solution, maybe a simpler solution for Randy, or just an alternative solution, let me know. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But after digging in, that's how I figured out how to do it. And then finally for today, what I have for you is a way you may be able to reclaim some precious hard disk space. Actually, this tip came via a post that Dave Hamilton made over on the Mac Observer website, and it is an awesome tip, something I had no idea, a place I never would have thought to look for before. I know a lot of the common locations that you'll go look for extraneous files and things like that that are using up disk space. But in this case, what Dave discovered was that his Twitter application, the official Twitter application, was eating up a ton of storage, almost 13 gigabytes of storage on his hard drive. And this is the app that was formerly from 8-Bits called Tweety. Twitter bought it and turned it into their own application. But apparently, because now of how OS X works in terms of the sandboxing, the OS X applications and their sandboxing, there is a place that apps now store files and cache files and stuff like that that's different than the one that we're used to. I would always check in your home folder inside the application, inside the library folder, rather, inside the application support folder, right? And you'd look there. You'd also look in the preferences folder and things like that. Well, it seems like now each application kind of has its own little space that has all of those folders or aliases of those folders in it. So if you go look in your home folder, inside the library folder, there's a folder called containers. And inside that, what you're going to see is a bunch of application namespaced folders. And that's just my fancy way of saying the com.developer.appname folder. So you'll see these folders, and they look like a lot like the plist files that you would normally see in home, library, system preferences, right? So you'd see all those kind of funky names, and you know which one belonged to which app and which developer by that naming convention. In this case, you've got a bunch of folders like that, And then within that, they each kind of have their own library folder. And looking inside that library folder, you see, again, a lot of the common things that you're used to, the familiar application support, preferences, application scripts, etc. folders are all inside there. So for the Twitter application, what you'll see is a com.twitter.twitter-mac folder. And inside there, there's a data folder, library, caches folder. And inside that, you've got com.8bits.tweety.profile images. And that's where Dave found that he had over 169,000 different image files using up 12.79 gigabytes of storage. And what they seemed to be were all the user profile images that were used by the Twitter application. So all those little thumbnail headshots that you see of all the people that you're following, those were all being pulled down and cached within that location. So he was able to just delete the caches folder, restart the application, the Twitter application, and it completely rebuilt that, but with a lot less data, so freeing up a ton of space. And Dave's piece was updated to note that the Twitter application actually has a empty cache option built into the application under the Twitter menu. So if you select that, what it actually does is goes in and deletes these cache files that are in this little special location. So you don't have to get into the library folder if you're a little bit leery about doing that, at least for the Twitter application to actually clear this stuff out. Unfortunately, if you use the thing from the application menu inside Twitter, it also does clear out the username autocomplete options within the application. But again, those would be rebuilt over time, so that may or may not be a big deal for you. But what it did uncover, and what was interesting to me, is that there's a lot of apps that store a lot of different kinds of data in this location or in this hierarchy. And so we kind of have this new area where you might want to go through and clean out files, especially if you are uninstalling applications, right? It could leave a bunch of data behind kind of in this location. And I will say, before you get in and mess with anything in here, one, you probably want to back up any files before you delete them, just in case, because who knows what applications are using and stuff for in here and what might be being stored. So I wouldn't just go through here willy-nilly and delete stuff. But you can poke around through there and maybe look and maybe find stuff. Back it up, throw it away, see if anything happens, and if everything's running still okay, you're probably fine, especially if you're dealing with cache files. Usually cache files will be rebuilt from most applications, but just word of caution, be careful and maybe do some Googling, look up and make sure that whatever you might be deleting or trying to throw away to free up space isn't going to cause you a problem. And as far as finding files and data and information, a good trick is to use some of the applications that are available to kind of find larger files. An application that I like to use is called Daisy Disk. I think I got it through the Mac App Store. And what it'll do is it'll go through and scan a hard drive or a volume or even a specific folder and pull out and give you a map of all the files that are in there by size. And so you can kind of see where the large ones are. So what I actually did is I ran Daisy Disk and pointed it at this home library containers folder. And sure enough, it found this odd 1.1 gigabyte video attachment file that was in my BusyCal data of all places. I don't know why or how it got in there, but it was just this little extraneous 1.1 gigabyte file. So I was able to actually throw that out and reclaim a little bit of space. I did not find any of the thumbnails like Dave did of his Twitter followers or the people he was following on Twitter. I had a few of them. I used Tweetbot, and my Tweetbot folder did have some of those cache files, but it was only a few hundred mega or 100K rather, not like gigabytes and gigabytes of files. But if you want to look for more files, you could use an application like WhatSize or Grand Perspective if you don't want to use Daisy Disk, although I'm not sure on the OS X Mavericks compatibility of those two applications. It looks like they hadn't been updated in a while. And you could maybe find some extra storage space on your hard drive by maybe cleaning out some of the stuff that's in this area. So great tip from Dave. You can read all about it over on the Mac Observer website if you'd like. But I thought I'd share it with you as well because I had no idea that we should be looking in this spot for extraneous files. And with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. And be sure to check out their newest app, PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for listening, for staying subscribed. I love getting feedback from you. I love getting audio comments. If you have a topic, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you have a question, something you need help with, I'd love to help you out. You can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and you can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And you can follow me on all the social media, twitter.com/maccast. There's a Facebook page, facebook.com/TheMacCast, and we also have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus, and I am sure you'll find it. And that's all the places we're hanging out online between shows. I'm posting stuff that I find interesting and what have you. Follow me there, and I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.